Welcome to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell. This afternoon I'm chatting with Dr. Rob Amery, who is Head of Linguistics at the University of Adelaide. Hello, Rob. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, hello, Kate. Thanks very much.
You've written something for our Indigenous issue of the MJA on the importance of language, of Indigenous languages and the way doctors communicate with their Indigenous patients. Tell us a little bit about Indigenous languages.
Well, maybe if we just give a little introduction to Indigenous languages. At the time of colonisation, there were at least 250 distinct languages, perhaps more, comprising 600 to 800 dialects, varieties that Indigenous people recognise as distinct. Sadly, however, at the last count, only 13 of those 250-plus languages are being acquired through natural means by younger generations. Despite that, we would still have over 100 of those languages spoken by native speakers, by first language speakers. Most of those languages are located in remote areas of the Northern Territory, of Kimberley and Pilbara in Western Australia, of North Queensland and Northern South Australia.
Are these languages written as well, or are they simply spoken languages?
They were never written prior to Europeans coming to Australia, but almost every language now has a established orthography, a writing system. A number of languages have Bible translations now, other materials coming out. Some, like Murinpata from around the Daly River area, is fairly well researched, and in fact there are many brilliant young researchers who are looking into many aspects of Murinpata at the moment. Other languages are very poorly documented. There are quite a number of other languages where significant language revival activity is occurring, and I myself have been working with the Kaurna language here in Adelaide, which is only known from written 19th century materials compiled by German missionaries. We don't have any sound recordings. We're working with written historical documentation. And that language has been reclaimed, been revived to the extent that there are now several young men who can conduct a conversation in Kaurna without resorting to English too quickly. And several children being raised as at least semi native speakers of that language. So we have a spectrum in Australia from very strong languages like Yolngamata or Walpuri or Pintabi, which are spoken by all generations for all everyday purposes within those communities, right down to languages where no longer spoken where there's very little documentation, very little known about them, and everything in between.
Have Aboriginal English hybrid languages developed as well?
Well, in two areas in Australia, in the Torres Strait, there is a Creole that has emerged, variously called Brokem or Torres Strait Creole or Yumplatuk. And then there is another Creole stretching across the Barkly Tablelands in the Northern Territory, around the Katherine area, Borroloola area, and right through the Kimberley, which is a result of a language that has grown up in the pastoral industry on those stations where there have been a lot of Aboriginal stockmen in the past. Of course, Aboriginal people also have their own varieties of Aboriginal English. Where I happen to live and work in Adelaide, this is known as Noongar English, and these varieties of Aboriginal English are in fact becoming more different to standard English, and many speakers of Aboriginal English nowadays are bidialectal. They speak standard Australian English, like other Adelaideans, for instance, at work or when they're meeting and talking with non-Aboriginal people, and within their own group, within their own Noongar Aboriginal society, they will speak Noongar English, which is a social dialect. It's much more intimate, much more familiar with family and friends and members of the community.
How does this impact the conversations Indigenous people have with doctors, particularly non-Indigenous doctors? Is it just a matter of language, or are there conceptual differences as well?
Well, in the perspective that I've contributed to the MJA at the moment, focusing specifically on those 50,000 to 55,000 Aboriginal Australians in remote areas who speak Indigenous language as a first language. And most of those people also speak English, but they speak it as a second language. And a few of those people are highly bilingual, highly bicultural. Others, there may still be a few remaining monolingual speakers, older members of those communities who have never had an opportunity of schooling. And, well, certainly when I was working in the health area in the 1980s, there were many, many older members of Gugudja Pindabi Pindada Society, for instance, whose knowledge of English was minimal. But probably most people from remote areas now have some English competency. And for most people, they're quite competent in being able to talk about everyday things. But when we get into specialist areas, like health, like the law, like social security, if they don't have a background in those particular areas, communication might be severely compromised without us even being aware that that's the fact, because these people come across as being very competent English speakers, and they are, in everyday matters. But if you don't grow up in a culture where we take the actions of antibiotics or immunizations or germ theory, we just grow up with those things in the family I grew up in, but that is not often the case for people who speak their own language as a first language and live and grow up and socialise in remote Aboriginal communities.
So how do we improve the way we communicate with Indigenous patients?
Well, there are many things that we need to do. And firstly, we need to take people's languages seriously. And it would be good if... Well, let's draw a contrast. If a doctor, a nurse, a professional goes to work in Tanzania,
yes,
as an Australian volunteer abroad, they will invest 4 months in learning Swahili before they go. And when they get there, the expectation is that they will continue their efforts to learn Swahili for the duration that they're there. And they will make a serious attempt to use Swahili in their dealings with patients, in the dealings with everyone there. They won't expect to use English. But when people work in remote areas in Australia, they expect, oh, well, this is Australia, everyone should speak English. And there is no recognition even of the importance of the languages that the other languages that people might bring. And this is most starkly illustrated in various policy we've seen from Northern Territory governments, where other people, migrants to this country from, well, be it Afghanistan, Sudan, China, wherever,
yes,
entitled to an interpreter, but there's great resistance for interpreting and translation for Aboriginal people. The attitude seems to be they've been in this country long enough, they jolly well should speak English. So if we're really going to get understandings across about treatment regimes, about Western health practices and procedures, then ideally this should be done in people's first language. Now, one way of beginning to get towards this is to employ a medical interpreter. Now, unfortunately here, the uptake of use of interpreters and translators within the health domain lags way behind the legal area, for instance. The uptake is not nearly as much. But even there, I think the model of engaging a generalist interpreter is flawed.
Why is that?
Well, if we get an interpreter to interpret for a Spanish person or a Vietnamese person or whatever, we don't expect that interpreter to have a background in medicine. But if we do get an interpreter, well, they have grown up in a culture themselves, Vietnamese culture or Spanish culture or whatever, where the same germ theory, the same antibiotics, the same
yes,
immunizations, the same procedures are practiced and are familiar with the general population. And so these concepts that we use as health professionals are readily translatable between English and Spanish and Vietnamese and Japanese, mm-hmm, and whatever. And if the interpreter is unfamiliar with certain terms, and they will be, because we're talking about a specialist body of knowledge here, it's not hard to pull out your iPhone and get a decent translation. But that is not possible if we're talking about Yungamata or Walpuri or Pindabi.
Mm-hmm.
These concepts haven't yet, by and large, been encoded in those languages. And you just can't employ the same kind of tools that a generalist interpreter for another world language has at their fingertips. So this, you know, presents a major obstacle here. My belief is that if we want to get decent medical interpretation to happen, then we should engage Aboriginal health workers to do that. Aboriginal health workers, well, they were really modelled on the Chinese barefoot doctor scheme. They were initially cultural brokers, they were medical assistants, they worked at the interface between the health service and the community. Now, many of my colleagues in the medical field will say, well, this is an unreal expectation for Aboriginal health workers. They're already far too much expected of them, and we shouldn't expect them to be interpreters and translators. Furthermore, we should have someone independent from the health service. But surely we should be able to work in the best interest of Aboriginal people, best interest of the community, and the best people placed to do this are the members of that community who have had a little bit of training in this area, and they are the Aboriginal health workers. And I would venture to say further that if interpreting and translation was part of their training and part of their expected role, you know, having to explain something to somebody in your own language and across languages will go a long way towards actually consolidating their understanding of those medical concepts. It will greatly assist their training, their professional development as health workers. And if you have to translate something, to interpret something, then you really need to know it. There is no training in interpreting and translation within the Aboriginal health worker certificates. Those certificates focus on first aid, on basic skills, diagnosis, treatment, and all of that is absolutely important, but they are not trained in medical interpreting unless they go off and do a separate interpreting course. It's not part of their established Aboriginal health worker training. As a general nurse myself, working in firstly Balgo in Western Australia in the Kimberley, and then at Papunya Wallangwurrung in the Northern Territory and up in northeast Arnhem Land. As a nurse working on the job, one of my main roles was Aboriginal health worker training.
Was that where you got interested in linguistics?
Yes, one of the main reasons, yes. I was interested in languages before I went nursing in remote areas, but when I arrived at Balgo, well, one of the first things I had to do was run around and take people's blood to check their status for syphilis. And I remember going to the wood heap and this man about to put the axe through my head, because blood is something sacred in these cultures. I know from working in the health area that we regard taking a urine sample as being something much, much more sensitive than taking a blood sample. We probably wouldn't even bother too much about feeling a need to draw the curtains, taking blood. But it's the exact opposite in those Indigenous societies. Blood is something sacred, something that which should be done in private. It's men's business. And if people don't know why we're just running around taking people's blood, well, no wonder. Sometimes they might be uncooperative. Fortunately, I had an Aboriginal health worker with me, and he was able to give some sort of explanation. I'm not quite sure what he said. But that man actually became quite compliant, quite happy to oblige, but initially he was not, and it was because these things had never been explained to him before. In that community, we had a visit from the flying doctor from Derby, and he said to me that, you know, the medicine we practice here is veterinary medicine, and I can't expect anything much more from him. He's based in Derby. He's flying to Balgo one day. He's flying to Bloomer, Fitzroy Crossing, Halls Creek, Mount House, I don't know, a dozen or so communities around the Kimberley, where a dozen or so different languages are spoken. Of course, he can't be expected to be across all of those languages. But the fact of the matter was that there was no attempt to communicate. He might as well have been treating a horse, looking at the symptoms, looking at the signs, and going from there.
That's really sad, isn't it?
But yes, and I don't know that the situation has improved much since then.
Clearly we need to take more time, or doctors need to take more time with their Indigenous patients.
Yes, taking time and trying to find meaningful ways to communicate things. Now, often there are simple little things in the language which can completely foul up communication. Let's say, for instance, that the health professional says, "You didn't take all the tablets, did you?" An English speaker is going to respond to that, No, they didn't take all the tablets. No, they just took one or two or whatever. A speaker of an Indigenous language is typically going to answer yes, meaning yes, I didn't take all the tablets. Now, they both have the same intention,
Yes.
The English speaker and the speaker of an Indigenous language. But the English speaker says no, the Indigenous speaker says yes. And then, if we're speaking with a fairly competent bilingual Aboriginal person, we're never sure which way they're answering. Are they answering the English way or are they answering the Indigenous way? Never be really sure. So it's a good idea to absolutely avoid those kind of double negative questions. And it's better to give Indigenous patients the time to explain in their own words.
Mm.
And typically there is a longer silence before speakers of Aboriginal languages will respond to a question. And if the question is important, it's probably important they take a little bit longer to consider the gravity of the question and to give a proper answer. And while we're waiting in silence, the silence was much longer than we used to, then we're often jumping in with another question, before that person has a chance to respond in their own terms, in their own way. It's a good idea to kind of sit side by side, then sit facing the Indigenous patient. People will feel more comfortable that way. There are different norms with regard to eye contact. And, to avoid eye contact in Indigenous society is to be respectful, to engage in eye contact. And I have been the subject of this when I was working as a nurse, and I was working in a community where there was a strong and powerful Ngankari, a traditional healer.
Yeah.
I was operating on his pat, and he certainly gave me direct eye contact, boring right through me. But for a patient who respects what a doctor or indeed a policeman or someone in authority has to say, it would be very rude for them to give direct eye contact. Now, this, of course, gives the Westerner, the non-Aboriginal professional, the idea that this patient is not really paying attention. They're not being respectful. They're not listening to what I'm saying. In fact, it's just the exact opposite. And that affects the quality of the communication when we don't have the shared understandings of how we go about communicating.
So step one is to recognise that there are Aboriginal languages out there that we need to be aware of. Are you optimistic about the way forward, or are people yet to actually take on board that there's a problem that needs fixing here?
A little bit of both, I think. The fact that the Medical Journal of Australia is taking the time to publish a few papers on these issues says we are making progress. But I guess, health professionals are busy people. They've got a lot of other demands on their time. I don't think they get training in these specific areas, and it's often a case of being totally unaware that these things are happening. Now, various researchers have done a little bit of research in this area. For instance, the Alan Cass and Anne Lowell and others in the renal unit in Darwin, and they give a case of a renal dialysis patient who was a graduate in teaching, had been a teacher for many years in Arnhem Land, a very fluent English speaker, and the nurse and this patient were not aware of any communication difficulty at all. They thought they were on the same plane. They were communicating well. It was only on post-exit interviews that it became apparent that they had very, very different understandings of treatment regimes and the nature of the condition. So these things are very subtle and often go under the radar. They're not just linguistic issues either. These are often issues of worldview.
Mm.
And if I can give one example, which I discussed briefly in the paper. Back in the 1980s, I worked with a Ngankari. Jabaljari was his skin name. Now, he had first met Europeans when he had a beard, so when he was a mature man, when a camel train came out from Hermannsburg. And he would come across as, being a fairly competent English speaker. Now, he was explaining to me out at Wallangaroo, which is nearly 600 kilometres from Alice Springs, but Alice Springs is the centre where people go to hospital and everything else. He was explaining to me where some family members of his were staying in Alice Springs. Now, I myself had lived in Alice Springs for 18 months, so I knew the town reasonably well, and I understood exactly what Jabaljari was saying. It wasn't a linguistic issue, but his explaining to me about the trees and the rocks and the everything else, how to get there, things that I had never paid attention to at all. I'm talking about streets, Bloomfield Street, major street in Alice Springs. He had never paid attention to street names, ever, and we just couldn't communicate. Wow. Even though we understood fully what each of us was saying, it wasn't a linguistic issue.
No.
It was starkly an issue of worldview. And I think we can extrapolate from that example to communication in the health area, where us as health professionals, we're coming from one perspective. We work with this set of instruments, this set of procedures, this set of medicines and treatment regimes, which are totally foreign to the worldview of people coming from those remote societies, where disease causation has much more to do with sorcery. And I remember from working up in northeast Arnhem Land, you know, some illnesses, ailments are referred to as wakin moriri, which is literally untamed illness. And well, immediately I would think of something pretty serious, something perhaps like cancer, but it's not that at all. These are travelling ailments, bit of diarrhoea, bit of a sniffle or something, which are just travelling around of their own volition. They're untamed. They're not under the control of a sorcerer.
Right.
If that diarrhoea became serious and that child became seriously dehydrated and, you know, in a life-threatening situation or something, it would no longer be wakingu. There would be someone behind that, someone working sorcery. There's no such thing as a natural death, unless perhaps you're very, very old or very, very young, but certainly within middle age, there's no such thing as a natural death, even if it is a helicopter falling out of the sky. Someone caused that. Someone was working sorcery. And, you know, people would tell me, well, you know, Western medicine, your way of doing things, it tells us how we get sick. It doesn't tell us why we get sick, why someone falls, prey to that infection and someone else doesn't.
Yep.
Why someone gets cancer and someone else doesn't. It is quite a different worldview. Well, I guess in terms of doing something practical now, without looking too much at the long term, diagrams and illustrations and demonstration are some of the best ways to go.
Like showing a patient how an implement works, for example.
Exactly, yes. Maybe showing how the otoscope is placed in the ear of the nurse standing alongside the doctor first before putting it in the patient's ear, or, yeah, actually demonstrating as much as is possible. And diagrams are always good to give some sort of language-free understanding of what might be happening.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kate.